Because in general, if one want to have a mean field approximation or a cluster mean field approximation, a requirement, the technical requirement is causality. So what I mean is that one would like to have that the imaginary part of the propagator are positive. So in this way, if one compute the spectral density, then the spectral density is positive, and then you can compare nicely with the experiment. And so we'll talk, in general, the causality is proven in different way for this, at least for these two scheme, and I will show a way which, in which one can prove very generally in the same, so using the same technique, the causality for these two scheme, one can prove that this scheme is not causal, and it's also important to, I think, to have an idea of really what one can do and what type of scheme one can introduce. And then I will talk about, I hope I will have time to talk about two applications. So one is just an application of toy model. The idea behind was just to benchmark this scheme and also, okay, and also compare to the other ones. And the toy model is the one-dimensional SUN Heisenberg chain. So this model has been already studied by Afflecker and Marston in two dimensions, and was in this study that they discovered the flat phase. So this model, when n goes to infinity, can be solved exactly, and so it's a good benchmark to test this this scheme. And then I will talk about some result on the Hubbard model at half filling without frustration. Okay, so let me just introduce very briefly dynamical mean field theory. So I think probably everybody knows dynamical mean field theory here. So just to set the notation. So how one can discover dynamical mean field theory? So dynamical mean field theory is a mean field theory for this type of system. So for a strongly correlated electron system. So here, for example, the Hubbard model. And I think has been applied with a lot of success to different context, but I will not discuss them. I will just introduce the theory. So the way, so let's say that you, I don't know, you pick a physicist and you put this physicist on a desert island, and this physicist doesn't know dynamical mean field theory. So how this physicist can discover? So the way to do this is just to try to solve this model in the limit of infinite dimension. So what one has to do is that, okay, first thing, you have to take the Hopping, the scale on the Hopping as 1 over square root of d, where d is the dimension. And then in this way, you have a good limit of the Hubbard model when d goes to infinity. Then, okay, if this physicist knows at least the solution of the Ising model in infinite dimension, he will know what he has to do. What he has to do, okay, first of all, he would like to compute the partition function. What he has to do is that he has to isolate a point, which is called cavity, and decompose the action in three terms. One, which is the action just of the cavity, so he has just the operator of the cavity. The other, which is the interaction between the cavity and the rest, so the cavity and the cavity field. And then there is the other part of the action, which is just, it contains just all the other operators. And then what this physicist has to do is, has to remark that because the dimension is going to infinity, so the connectivity of the cavity is going to infinity, and the scaling of the Hopping is taken such a way that everything is going to be fine. And then he can apply the central limit theorem, and he can see that the effective action for the cavity will be of this type. So the cavity will have a Weiss field, which is just a renormalization of the bare propagator for the cavity. And one can express easily this Weiss field in terms of Gij of 0, where Gij of 0 are just the propagator that you can obtain when you trace out all the fermion fields except the one of the cavity. So in general, what you want to obtain is Gij when you trace out all the fermionic operator. This is when you trace out all the fermionic operator except the cavity 0. So this is the relation, and then, okay, so the physicist has to work a little bit more, but then he will find the two equations, which are the two fundamental equations of dynamical mean field theory. So the first one, which seems very easy. So if you look at this, so the first one is just the Dyson equation. So G00 is the propagator on the cavity, it's not by a frequency. And so this seems just the Dyson equation, but there is one thing which is important, is that here sigma does not depend on K. So this is the first thing. Then he will find another equation, and the other equation is, again, a Dyson equation, that is the Dyson equation for the impurity problem. So it seems that there is nothing here because we have just the Dyson equation, but actually there is a lot of information. And one is that the sigma does not depend on K, and the other one is that the sigma which is here is the same the one that is there. So this means that the self-energy for the lattice and the self-energy for the single side problem are the same, and the G00 is clearly the same between the two. Okay? So these are the equations that you have to solve, and the way to solve, the algorithmic way, is just you start with the sigma, then you use equation 1 to get the G00, then you use equation 2 to get the Weiss field. When you have the Weiss field, you know what is the effective action, so you have to compute the functional integral. So you can do, for example, this by QMC or by some approximate technique. Then you get the propagator for the cavity. Then you use equation 2, because you know this and you know this, and you compute sigma, and then you start again. And you hopefully you arrive at convergence. So this is just the very brief introductions to the MFT. So as I said before, the MFT have been applied in different contexts, and has been successful. And so why people have tried to extend dynamical mean field theory, and how they have tried to do it. So there are three reasons which actually more or less come from experiment. And so the first one is that in experiment, for example, in high temperature superconductor, you can find broken symmetry, like for example the D superconductivity, or let's say there are some idea that there are some broken symmetry that could be important, like the D density wave. And this broken symmetry cannot be described within the dynamical mean field theory. So dynamical mean field theory, the elementary degrees of freedom is just one side. And to describe this type of broken symmetry, you have, so the elementary degrees of freedom should be at least a cluster of 2 by 2 sides. And then the other reason is that, again, in the experiment, you see that the self-energy can be strongly K-dependent, can be have very different behavior in different region of Fourier space. And what I've shown before is that dynamical mean field theory gives you a self-energy which is K-independent, so it's constant on the Fourier space. So you would like to have a sort of scheme which systematically can introduce a sort of better and better resolution in K-space. So the zero-order approximation will be the MFT, then you will have a one first-order approximation in which you have a certain type of resolution, and then systematically you can increase the resolution of K-space of for sigma. And then the other thing is that you would like to, there are some cases in which you would like to capture the effect of short-range fluctuation that you can have inside the cluster, but that you can have you can't have for a single site. So, okay, so this is why. I think also one has to be clear that this perhaps could be a good way, so a good mean field theory to apply to a problem in which just short-range fluctuations are important. It's certainly not a good technique to apply to a problem which has long wavelength and fluctuation which are important. And, okay, so now I would like just to describe two different routes that one can follow, try to extend the dynamical mean field theory. And I will just focus on the second one. So these two routes are related to two different things that you could want to improve. So the first one is that we have seen, so dynamical mean field theory is the exact solution of an infinite dimension. But then you can apply just like the mean field approximation to a system in finite dimension. And you know what that in infinite dimension, what dynamical mean field theory does is that, so if you want the cavity field which is coupled to the cavity, which is the interaction between the cavity and the rest of the system, is Gaussian in the limit of infinite dimension. And then then what happens is that you will have a Weiss field which renormalize the Bayer propagator for the cavity. And so what you could want to do is just to go beyond this Gaussianity of the cavity field, or if you want to do a renormalization also of the two particle reducible vertex. And this is done in a not complete way, but in a partial way by the extended dynamical mean field theory. But I will not talk about that, I will talk about this. So the other idea is just that in dynamical mean field theory, the elementary degrees of freedom is just one side coupled to the rest, and then you go from one side to a cluster of sides. And the idea is that if you have a cluster of sites, then you can try to describe this type of broken symmetry. I will show that you can introduce a certain resolution in Fourier space, and then you can also capture some effect of short-range fluctuation. So, so let me introduce the first type of cluster dynamical mean field approximation or mean field theory. So this one is called CDMFT, cellular dynamical mean field theory, has been introduced by Gabby Kotler, Safrasov, Parson, and myself. And the idea, the idea is, as I said before, just that the elementary degrees of freedom will not be a site, but just a cluster of sites. So what you do is that you take your lattice, let's say a two-dimensional lattice, and you write this just a super lattice of cluster. So this, for example, a cluster, a 2x2 cluster, okay? And then the elementary degrees of freedom are C and C dagger inside the cluster. Then you can rewrite the Hamiltonian in this way. So N and M are the index of the cluster. Alpha and beta are the index inside the cluster. So what you have is a sort of matrix formulation in which you have an opening between the cluster. And then this is a matrix with index alpha and beta. Alpha and beta are the index inside the cluster. And then, there is a complicated way to rewrite the Happard interaction. And then the equation are really the same for the MFT, except that now you have matrix and not you don't have just C number. And so the first equation, which was the Dyson equation that I described before, which relate G to sigma. And so now you have the same type of equation. The difference is that T, sigma, G are matrix. And moreover, here, when you do the sum over K, K means the Fourier is the K in the Fourier space of the super lattice, so the lattice of cluster. And then the second equation is the equation which gives the cavity field if you know the propagator and sigma, and again this is just a matrix equation. So you see, it's a real just a matrix generalization of the MFT. There is one thing which is different, however.
Sorry, just to be sure I understand all the information.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So the difference is that before we have said that, if we know sigma for a single, so for the MFT, if we know sigma, that's alpha energy, which is the solution of the MFT equation, then we say simply that sigma lattice is just sigma lattice in Fourier space is just the sigma that you get. So it's a constant in Fourier space. Now, the problem is that there is not a unique way to get sigma lattice from the sigma that you obtain from the CDMFT equation. So the simplest thing that you can do is this thing. So what you have is that at the end of the solution, so how you can solve the problem, again, is always the same algorithm. You start with the sigma, with the guess on sigma, then you use 1, you get G. From G, you know G0 from 2. And then what you have to do is that you have to solve a cluster impurity problem. So you have to do, if you want numerically, a functional integral for a cluster with an effective action. Then you get the new propagator. And then when you have the new propagator from this equation, you know G, you know G0, and then you get sigma, and then again, until you arrive at convergence. But when you have the solution, when you have convergence, you will have a sigma. But from sigma alpha beta, how you can derive sigma lattice? There is not a unique way. The simplest way that you can think of is this one. So what you are saying is that the sigma lattice of I omega n and x is just, so you extract this in terms of sigma alpha beta, making just a sum over all alpha and beta such that x alpha minus x beta, x beta is equal to x. And then you divide by the number of sites in the cluster. So what you are saying is just that you look at what are the, for example, the nearest neighbor self-energy inside the cluster, and from there you get an expression for sigma lattice. Okay.
But the sigma lattice is only used at the very end of the game?
Yeah, only at the very end.
No.
And how severe is the point that you At the beginning, you had all the bonds were equal, but now you treat bonds within the cluster different from bonds between the clusters.
Yeah.
So could you somehow improve on this by using such a formula like sigma lattice?
This one? Yeah, the problem, yeah, which
but you don't do it.
Yeah, I don't do it, and the reason which is that, as I said before, you, in general you want a scheme which preserves causality. And if you do this, in general it doesn't preserve causality. Yeah. The different cluster, yeah. What one can improve, if one can. Sorry?
If Anton can say that you migrate for stability, you always use such a sigma lattice.
Yeah.
But if you only use it at the end, the sigma lattice is called.
Yeah, yeah, I will show how.
So if you can use it for the equation with sigma lattice,
I don't know, let's say that you want the sigma lattice nearest neighbor for a cluster which is like this 1, 2, 3, 4. So this will be 1 divided by 4, and then, okay, times. So you will have, so nearest neighbor, I mean, it will be, for example, 3, 2. Sorry, I mean, 3, 2 in the lattice. So this will be sigma 3, 2 plus sigma 4, 1. Divided by 4. 3, 2, 4, 1. Sorry?
Or because there's sigma 3 pattern or something like that, which is here?
No, but there is also sigma 2, 3 and sigma 1, 4.
No, because, okay, sigma 1, 4 is the symmetry. Okay, if you, then if you want sigma 2, 3, sigma 2, 3 will be 1 divided by 4, and then you will have sigma 1, 4 plus sigma 2, 3.
I think because there are two additional sigma. Zero.
Sorry?
Well, there's 2, 1, 3, 4.
2, 1, 3, 4. Yeah, but 2, 1, 3, 4, okay. I don't use in the symmetry of the lattice. 2, 1 is, here is related to x, which is the unit vector in this direction, okay? So the only thing that I can take from the cluster is 3, 2 and 4, 1 are the only one that I can use.
Yeah, but isn't it wonderful for, because in principle you have the lattice that is on the right hand side of lattice side 3 is another lattice side.
Yeah, so,
sigma 3 center is 0.
Yeah. So you start to see also problems. Here you see if you have a cluster which is not too big, it's not very good what you are doing here. You have very big finite size effect because you are divided by 4, something in which you have just 2 elements. Okay, which, yeah.
The question of how to reconstruct the lattice energy from your center set energy matrix is logically independent from solving that circle problem.
Exactly.
You could cook a 100 different schemes to get to sigma lattice.
Yeah, exactly. So you can think that this is one scheme, and then there is, depending on your problem, depending on your model, you can choose a different way to get sigma lattice. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You have just
to make a partition.
Yeah, no, I agree. There is different way to do this. The only requirement is that you have to do something which preserves causality. It's just the only thing.
But you could restore the translational symmetry by
taking one partition with your red thing, and a second one which moved over one, and a third one which moved vertically one. I mean, there are, I think, four partitions of the original lattice of this type. And if you took the average of all those four, it would at least restore the translational symmetry.
The average, you mean, with so you say that sigma, I don't know.
Hamiltonian.
Yeah, okay, is, okay.
You know, so basically four sets of
yeah, okay, we can discuss. Okay, but I agree completely, yeah.
Could you comment what is the difference between this image we call like tree cluster or molecular cluster and cellular, really? Because it's up to now it's still not cellular.
Yeah, okay, just because here in principle what one can use a basis which is not orthogonal, so I can just take something which is not just a cluster of four sides, but something which is, I don't know, is localized on some...
No, it's just free
yeah, cluster. It's just free cluster, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was just to make things simple. Then I can, if I want, do a non-orthogonal transformation from C to other things, and then redo the same method. Okay, so this was the several GMFT. Now, we discussed the other one, which is dynamical cluster approximation, which has been introduced by Jarrell and co-worker. And the idea, okay, the intuitive idea, again, is that you would like to have a certain resolution in K-space. So so in the NFT, what you have is you have a sigma which is constant in Fourier space. So let's say that this is Fourier space, so for a two-dimensional system. So the idea behind the CA, at least how the things are how I understand it, is that what you want to have, you want to go from something which is completely constant to something which is a piecewise constant in K space. So it has a value in this square, it has a value in this square, and it has another value in this square. So that's the idea. So let me now just go through the two equations. So the equation of VCA are similar to the one of the MFT. The first one is the one which relates the propagator to the self energy. So what you have to do, you have to make the sum over all k inside the square. Let me see what is kc. So kc is just the Fourier vector which related to the center of the square, of the small square. And what you have to do here, you have to make the sum over all k which belong to the square with index kc.
Little k depends on two images. Yeah?
Little k. No.
T depends on
this
k.
T? Yeah, no. T. Sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. T of k. Yeah. 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 Okay. And so what you're doing, so this is the first equation, which is a sort of average of what you have inside the square to get g of k, c of I omega n. And then this is the other equation which relate g and sigma to the Weiss field, which is again is very similar to the one of the MFT.
Could you comment on this? What is
it? Why?
Could are there proofs that this is this way? Why is k by k?
K by K?
KC by KC. So this is a scalar, not now metric.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a scalar. It's not a matrix. Actually, what you are doing with respect to the other case is not exactly this. No. Yeah, the cavity is not based on the cavity procedure.
Yeah.
It's much more based on this idea that you want something which is more or less constant in the small squares, and then you want also to have a sort of you want to force translation invariance, because what you see the problem of CDMFT is that you are not able to do the cavity procedure exactly, and because you are not able to do the cavity procedure exactly, you lose in a certain sense a translation invariant inside the cluster. Whereas here you have translation invariant inside the cluster.
I don't understand what is G0, what is the physical meaning now when you say G0. It's cavity for KC?
No, I agree. I agree. I don't understand exactly what it is, in the sense that it's a sort of mix of Fourier space and real space.
Prodigy field. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Then, sigma has a physical meaning if you have the DMFT on the one hand and the Fourier space on the other hand. And
so then you use G0 to solve it.
But in DMFT, this color difference is physical meaning.
Yeah, it means that.
Yeah. What is it?
Yeah.
Well, if you don't know. Then
no, I agree. It seems a mix of Fourier space and real space.
Right.
So I understand the part of Fourier space, but I don't understand exactly the part of real space.
Okay.
So one can get, anyway, one can go through CDMFT to DCA, just make a slight change in the equation. So if you have a CDMFT code, then you can get the DCA. Yeah. Yeah.
That within DCA, you think of that and then you envision, which is a very clever prediction, that there is better boundary conditions on the vector.
Yeah.
So it gives you an idea which is very difficult to reconcile with the notion of the cavity construction.
Yeah, if the cavity was exact, you will have a periodic boundary condition.
Now,
yeah.
Now the problem is careful.
Yeah.
Okay, so it says that if you force your boundary
condition,
then
I agree. Almost give you DCA, not completely. You have just to change a little bit the hopping inside also, but okay, yeah. Okay, so, and now, so if you have, or again, if you solve the problem here, you have a sigma of Kc, then what you say is that sigma lattice of K, I am again, is sigma of Kc of K, where Kc of K, so it's just the function that if you give key, it gives you the Kc, which is at the center of the square in which K is. So you have a function which is a piecewise constant in K space. And again, one can prove that this scheme is causal. So I will show after. Okay, so now just the third scheme, which seems a little bit more complicated, which is, I don't know, this scheme has been introduced by, I think, Ingersant and Schiller, and also Georges and Cotrier. I don't know what is the official name. I call it pair scheme. I don't know if it's link scheme or... Anyway, so the idea is behind this is that, so what you would like to have is the self-energy with this type of form in K-space, and where so C of K is the Fourier transform of the connectivity matrix of the lattice. So for example, for a cubic lattice, it will be just cosine of Kx plus cosine of Ky plus cosine of Kz. And you can also understand what it is if you go to real space. If you go to real space, so this means that sigma ij is different from zero only if I is equal to j or I nearest neighbor of j. And sigma ii will be equal to sigma local, and sigma ij, sigma nearest neighbor will be equal to this term. Okay, the difference with respect to the other scheme is, so the first difference is that to solve this problem, we need two impurity problems, one impurity problem for one side and impurity problem for two sides. And so the equation, again, perhaps are not so clear because they are written in such a way to solve the problem of overcounting, so it seems a little bit complicated. So there is the first equation, which again relate G once you know sigma, and sigma is defined here, it's the same one that was there. And then you have two equations which gives you the cavity field, the Weiss function for the one impurity problem and the two impurity problem, which relate G0 to G log. And sigma 1, so sigma 1 for the moment is different from sigma log and sigma n, and so this is the Weiss field for the two impurity problem, and here you have the sigma 2, which is different for the moment, and then you have the equation which relates sigma log and sigma n to sigma 1 and sigma 2, which are this one. So I think we'll be clear when I will talk about functional. For the moment it's not so clear. And then the algorithm to solve this problem is always the same. You start with sigma 1 and sigma 2. Then you compute sigma log and sigma n with these two equations. Then you compute g log and g n using this equation. And then you use these two equations to have the device field. Then you do the quantum Monte Carlo for the one, so the one impurity problem and the pair impurity problem, and then you get G log and G n, and then again until you reach convergence. Okay? Z, sorry. Z is the connectivity of the lattice. Okay, so for the moment I think perhaps it's not so clear, but I think the real way to understand this is just to look in terms of functional, and then it will be clear later. And then I think if one understands well this, okay, one could improve also in principle, so have a more complicated key dependence. Okay, so now... I think so. I didn't really. Yeah. But that's true. But the problem is that the scheme is not causal. So it's not causal.
Well, there's a recent paper by the Rand Fox.
Yeah.
Where they claim that the non-causality only arose previously due to numerical instability situation. Now,
but I I want to show you that it's not causal. So there is, I mean, you compute the self-energy to the second order in U, and you can find the mapping in such a way that the self-energy is not causal. No, it's just you take the equation for this problem. You take your equation when U is going to zero, so at the second order in U, and you choose a G0, you are the freedom to choose G0, so the hopping. And you are going to choose, one can choose an hopping which gives the self-energy which does not go on.
You?
Yeah. What I'm saying is not that, I mean, you can be in a region of parameter F1 in which you don't see a problem of causality. But if you want to prove causality in general, the scheme is not causal. So then it depends on the model and on the parameter and etc. Yeah. Yeah, actually, we are really working on that with Gabi Kovler. So we have tried to show before to understand if it's causal or not, and then when we discover that it's not, and actually it was something which was already known, we discovered. If you look at the same scheme for this other system, this problem was solved by Mills, the same of Young-Mills theory, which showed that the same scheme is not causal in the case of this other system, but he had found the way to repair the scheme. And the scheme is called the traveling cluster approximation, which is rather hopeful. Yeah, it's still the 1 over D, but the dependence on K-space is much more complicated, but he can solve the problem with just exactly. So we are trying to work it to see if we can repair this in post-strongly correlated aircraft. Yeah? Yeah, he's changing the. I would say he's changing the impurity problem here. I will. We can just. In any case, when I will discuss about causality, it will be much clearer what he has done, and then we can discuss also later. Yeah.
I was never quite sure
when
working on this whether the common road is going to work.
That's the point.
In principle, if you were able to solve the Z side cluster
Yeah.
You would have everything correct as one to order one over D, and you wouldn't have a causal. You would have a causal solution. Is that your?
The Z. You mean the site and the neighbor.
So obviously.
I think this will solve the counter example that I have, mm-hmm. but I think that there is another problem which arises at higher order in when you do the perturbation, which was the one discovered by Mills. But I will show what is the problem, so you can discuss later. Okay, so now, so let me just discuss in terms of functional what are all these schemes. I will try to go rather quick, so I can discuss more interesting things. So in terms of functional, what you have to do is, okay, this is what is called, I don't know if it's called Brinca, I don't know for Latin word, but okay, the generating functional for the propagator and the self energy, and if you extremize this with respect to G and sigma, you get minus beta F, where F is the free energy. And it's defined this way, it's minus trace of log of this, which is just G minus 1, minus trace of sigma and G, and sigma G are considered operator. And then you have this part, which is the sum over all the two particle reduced from vacuum diagrams with full propagators G. If you look at what are the two equations, the externalization equation, so the first one is just the Dyson equation, and the other one relates sigma to G. And so here, if you want, if you know G, you can plug G here, you compute sigma as a function of G, then you put sigma here, and then you try to solve the problem in this way. So in general, you don't know phi, but you can do some approximation for phi. And DNFT, what DNFT is doing, you're just doing this. What you do is that you make a sum over I, and then you take the complete phi, and you put to zero all the propagator between k and l, except if k is equal to I and l is equal to I. So this is DNFT. And so what you see, you start to see that So this is written as a sum over I, the same functional, which is a function of GII. So you start to see how the equation of DNFT shows up. So the first thing is that when you derive phi with respect to G, you will have just the only non-zero term is sigma II. So the sigma is a constant in K-space. And then the other thing is, so to get the equation for the impurity problem, and this, okay, I've written this, but perhaps this is a little bit complicated. So what you do is that you use that. So what the trick is that the function which is here is the same function that you have just for one single site. So if you are able to solve one single site, in principle, you should be able to obtain this, because this is the same just for a single site. So let me express this functional in a different way. So I will use exactly this equation for just for one site. And I will not use sigma, but I will use G0, where G0 is at the same time, if you want, the Weiss field or the Bayer propagator, depending on the interpretation that you want to give. So the Bayer propagator for the single site. And so what, using the same equation, what you get is that pi DNFT of G, so this, is just the extremum on G0 of this, that in principle you could compute with the impurity, if you are able to compute the impurity, solve the impurity problem, plus, so these two terms, which was on the other side before. So now if you derive this with respect to G0, what you get is that you get the GII, which is here, should be equal to the G of the cavity that you compute from the impurity problem. And if you derive with respect to G, what you get is this sigma II for the lattice should be equal to G0 minus 1 minus G minus 1, so it should be equal to the sigma of the impurity. Okay, so okay. Let me now say what are the other schemes in terms of functional. So the other scheme, so the first thing is CDNFT. So CDNFT is really a generalization of what I've shown before. So you make a sum over all. So before you did, what you did is you make a sum over all sites, and then you put to zero all the propagator except GII. And here what you do is you make a sum of a whole cluster, and for each cluster you put to zero all the propagator except the propagator in which K and L belong to the same cluster N. And then, okay, if you derive, you will see that you obtain exactly the same equation that for CDNFT. And again, the trick is that now this thing is just a thing that you are able to compute if you are able to compute an impurity problem for the cluster. Now DCA is again slightly different. It's always you because they look the things in a different way from Fourier space. And so the idea of DCA in this case is that, okay, 5D MFT, you can look at 5D MFT in this way. Another way to look at this is just saying that you take all the diagram, so in all the diagram you have a vertex, so in each vertex you have the conservation of the momentum, and what you do is just, to obtain the MFT, is just you throw away the delta, you put the delta equal to 1. And when you do this, you obtain the MFT. And you obtain the MFT just because if you throw away the delta, you can do all the integral on each line, and so each line becomes just the propagator for the single side problem. And then the DCA is the same thing, but what you have to do now, you replace the delta with a sort of coarse grain delta, not just one, but this, which a delta with the cluster momenta, okay? Where K1C, so KC is again, is defined like before. So if you give K, KC of K is the KC at the center of the square in which K is. And then the pair scheme, again, is now I think it's clear what it is. So it's the sum of these two things. So five single sides, the five that you have if you just solve the one single side, so one impurity. And five pair is the one that you have if you just solve two sides. And you see why you have this term, which is the connectivity, is just because when you do this, what you have is that you will have a term which is phi single side GII, which is inside this, and you have also the term phi single side GJJ, which is inside this, and so you have to subtract this term to not do an overcounting. Yeah?
Then the phi of GII that remains just exactly coincides with that of the single side of the fluid model. Which is the key behind the
success
of the MFT.
Yeah.
The nasty point is that when we go to a cluster, there is no way to find something analogous to that. And if I decide to compose the Green's function, except the on side and the nearest neighbor one, to zero,
yeah,
my exact Lattice function. There is no simple, at least that I know, there is no simple cluster functional that will be identical to that of that truncated lattice function.
Exactly.
Certainly this PDMFT one is not doing the job.
Yeah.
I thought the motivation of the pair scheme was to construct one which would do that.
Exactly. Job. Yeah, exactly. I agree. And what needs what is...
That sounds like a very reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah.
But
what I think what Mills was able to do is really, he didn't really take, in his case, the functional, and he put to zero everything except the nearest neighbor and the single side, but he was able to take a subclass from this thing when you put to zero everything except GII and GIJ, and this subclass he was able just to solve with any sort of impurity problem, and he was also able to show that this was causal. So. I think, I agree. This is the most appealing one. But
well, no, that's not what I want to say. I mean, I just want to point out what the logic problem is behind all that. The problem is that the PDMFT function, I mean, the three cluster function, does the job provided you truncate the lattice functional in a translationally
non-invariant way. Yeah.
With all the nearest neighbor lines connecting that to zero.
Yeah. I agree. Okay, so now I will just talk about causality, so to discuss so why the pair scheme is not causal, how one can try to extend scheme, and why CDMFT and DCA are causal. So just when I say that causality, I mean, I will just focus on the fact that what one wants is that the imaginary part of G, which will be the solution of the cluster dynamic and mean field approximation, one would like the imaginary part of G is positive definite. So again, if you look in terms of functional, so the different dynamical mean field approximation, what they are doing are just two coupled equation. If you know sigma, you compute G from the Dyson equation, and if you know G, you compute sigma from this equation, and then you iterate. So to prove that the system is causal, what you can do, okay, first thing is you start with the sigma which is causal, and you try to prove that if sigma is causal, G will be causal, and it is easy to do. And the other hard part is that if you say now that G is causal, you would like to prove that sigma is causal when you choose the phi which is related to your preferred mean field approximation. And then you have to show that then for every choice of G or sigma will be causal. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it is true that it is true that the as a matrix.
Yeah.
It is matrix inversion, right, minus one. So to prove that the matrix that sigma I j optimized by beta or other operate causality properties, then the matrix the alpha beta also.
I have already thought about that. I always thought that I think the hard part was this one and not this one. But okay. Huh? Yeah. Okay. No, okay, I agree. But yeah, okay, no, I agree. This I agree. But I mean they look like this because phi is just a sum over an infinite series of diagrams. It's no, okay. No, actually here I just looking if the imaginary part of G or the imaginary or defined like a matrix, so it will be this the definition in the case if, in which is a matrix. So if G is not a matrix, I will ask that the imaginary part of G is positive, definite. And when you have a matrix, for example, when sigma is a matrix, I will ask that this thing is positive, definite. Okay, so now let me see in why so this how one can prove this part. And so to prove this part is slightly awful, but so what actually you have to use a trick which and you if you think just a little bit, what you want to do is that if you have a diagram in general, you want to know what is the imaginary part of the diagram, and then sigma is a sum of diagrams, so what you want to do is to prove that the sum over all, if you take the imaginary part of the sum of all the diagrams, then the imaginary part is positive. So what you are able to do, I mean, the elementary step is, given a diagram, compute the imaginary part. And okay, this is something that has been, that is known in the literature, in field theory, and it's called the Kapowski equation or Toffenberg-Van-Cutting equation, which actually we have already derived with Gabby in the case of non-translation invariance. And so the basic rule is, let's say that sigma is given by a generic diagram, okay? Like this one, which is very generic. And then you want to compute this thing, because it's this thing that, like a matrix, should be positive definite. If you want to compute this, you can show that this thing, if sigma is given by this diagram, is given by this equation. So let me explain what this equation is. So first thing, you have to make a sum over all the cuts that you can do, all the way that in which you can cut the diagram in two pieces. So if you have the diagram, a cut means that you just cut a certain number of lines, and the diagram is divided in two pieces, one left and one right. So what you have to do is that you have to make the sum over all possible ways to cut the diagram. When you cut the diagram, you cut n propagators, so you will have some x1, x2, xn that you are cutting. You will have a left part, and then what you have to do is you have to make a sum over x1, x2, xn, an integral over all the frequencies, which are ingoing and outgoing. And then you have to put inside the integral and the sum, so the left part of the diagram, and the mirror image of the right part. So you take the right part, and you take just the mirror image of this, okay? And then, because you have cut some propagator, you replace the propagator with the spectral density related to each propagator, okay? And then you have also an Heaviside function, which is is theta of omega if omega is outgoing, or theta minus omega if omega is ingoing. And then you have the conservation of the frequency. And then the important thing is that here you have this diagram is conjugated. So, okay, this for the moment.
So is this only the first set energy or already the second?
No, is this is sigma x x prime omega minus sigma conjugated x prime x omega divided by E is equal to that, when sigma is given by this diagram. Okay, this is just okay for the moment, it's very formal. So let me show how one can use this to prove causality at the second order in U. And then you will understand how to do it to the whole order, hopefully. So, okay, let's say at the second order you have this diagram for the self-energy. So what you want to compute is this diagram minus the same with x prime and x, and then the conjugated. And then you want to prove that if you put a Wx and Wx prime conjugated and you divide it by E, this is positive definite for any choice of W. And then what you do is you apply the rules that I gave before, so you can just do one cut, so cut in this way. When you cut in this way, you have a left part, which is this one, and then you will have the mirror image of the right part, which is that one. Okay? Then you have the integral over the frequency, the sum over x, x prime, x, 1 prime, etc., and then the spectral density. Now, the trick is that what you want to do is that you would just rewrite this thing like an integral and the sum of squares. And so, because it's a sum of squares, it will be positive definite. And what you do, okay, you use that G is causal, so this means that has a spectral density which is positive definite, like a matrix. So you write this like in a spectral representation, like V alpha of X, V alpha of X prime. So V alpha is the eigenvector with eigenvalues lambda alpha. And okay, I just skip all the omega because it's not important now. And you know that V alpha should be positive definite. If you plug this expression here, what you can put, you put the V alpha inside V alpha 1 here, V alpha 1 conjugated here, V alpha 2 and V alpha 2 conjugated here. At the end, you end with this expression, so you have sum over alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, the integral with all the frequency and the delta also to enforce the frequency conservation. But then what the important thing is that you can rewrite everything as as a square. So you have this with the Wx and the V and the sum over x, x prime, x2, there is no x prime here, it's a sum over x1, x2, and x3, and here is x prime, x1 prime, x2 prime, x3 prime. So these are positive, this is a square, so everything is positive definite. Yeah?
I have a question. For example, the data we consider here as a little bit of a special property, right, which is that the left part and the right part are just the same.
Exactly.
So this is how you get the square.
Exactly. That's the trick. I mean, you know, you mean, no.
What about one which wouldn't be like that?
Exactly. If you take one which is not like that, in general, the imaginary part is not positive definite. But then if you take the class of the whole diagrams, and you take, now is what I'm saying just after, so let me say what I... So, if you know what you want to do when you have many diagrams, and in principle you don't have this nice property, okay. So what you have to prove is that, so in principle you have a sum of a diagram, and then for each diagram you have to do all the cuts. And what you want to show is that you can rewrite this as the sum of all the type of cuts. So for example, one type of cuts is just n lines. And then here you put all the half left diagrams of your theory, which end with this type of cuts. And here all the, okay, mirror image of the all half left, which is... And this, okay, this is the way to prove that the theory is causal. Just in perturbation theory, the quantum field theory is causal, and there's a way to prove that this CA, okay, perhaps it's not an easy way, but okay, if you just think that is correct, you have just to prove that these two things, you can write this as a sum over square. This can be done in DCA and CDMFT. I mean, it's, you have just to think a little bit, and you have just to be sure that what you have to do is just, you take all the diagram, you take all the type of cuts, you take all the half left diagram, all the half right diagram, you just write this, and you have just to check that you obtain all the diagrams which are there with no overcounting and no...
The topology of the diagram is more like a form.
Yeah. No, okay, I mean for the general theory is known, is Katowski talked, I mean, when there was the problem of unitarity in field theory, the people have started to look at that. But, okay, in general, it's, I mean, for CDFT DCA, you just look at the diagram is just the diagram that you have just for a cluster, like you can easily prove that you have this. And it's what Mills also looked at when he tried to generalize the pair scheme. So now I will just discuss, I will probably don't have time.
Left-hand side is different from right-hand side.
I show now. Yeah, the problem is that, okay, I show now, exactly now for the pair scheme, one of the problems. So, okay, as I said, you can do CDNFT, you can check, but you can rewrite as the sum of the square, the CA as the sum of the square. And the pair scheme actually has two problems. So I would like to stress one thing, that if you are not able to write the thing like a sum of the square, you are not proving that the thing is not causal. You are just proving that you are not able to prove that it's causal. But okay, it's just an hint that perhaps things are going wrong. And this is what actually Mills did for the equivalent of the pair scheme in the case of disorder system. And the thing is not closure because, okay, has a problem. And this problem is non-closure. So when you take all the left diagram and you take all the right diagram, so the pair scheme, you can have something which starts with I, which ends with a certain number of I lines, but inside has a JJ. Okay, J is nearest neighbor of I. This is a diagram which is allowed in principle. It's a half-left diagram which is allowed. Then a half-right diagram which is allowed that you can find is something in which you have all the I here, but inside here you have a JIK. This is a half-right diagram which is allowed. I mean, I can find this cutting a diagram. But then when I put the two things together, I found the diagram which is not allowed. So when I try to rewrite the things like a sum of a square, I end up with new terms, and I don't know what to do. Again, this is not a proof that it, yeah.
But if you sum all of them up, you would have all the sum of the left-hand diagram, you
would
have the J and the K,
both of them
end up.
Yeah, so this is not allowed. That's the problem. When you define the pair scheme, you just want things in which you have just JJ or IJ. And here we are producing a diagram in which this is why the mid scheme is called traveling, because he solved the problem and then he can have a scheme which travels in the sense that he had from I to K, you can go to the J, and from J you can go to K, from K you can go to L, and etc. So okay, so I can say, so this is not a proof that the system is not causal, but it's a problem if you want to prove causality. So what Mills did in the case of these other electrons is actually to put many diagrams inside in such a way that there is this problem of non-closure is not there. So we can discuss later in details. Yep.
But when you are saying that when you enter the ginger of causal, not causal, that applies to the linear combination of that sigma 1 and what
might not to the real self energy. Now what I'm saying is, second point. If you look at the self-energy at the second order in U, just this. So sigma ij equal to this, and sigma ij is equal to this. If you just take your phi 1 and phi 2 with I minus z and etc., at the end what you get is phi sigma I is equal to this one, sigma ij is equal to this one. You agree? So in principle, here these things will be z this time minus z minus 1, the same thing. So okay. So it's just the expression of the second order. And what I say is that now if you look at these two equations, it's just like the second order perturbation theory for the standard problem, but in which you have just put into zero all the things in your self-energy which are not II and IJ. And if you do this, in general, even if the self-energy with all the terms is causal, when you put to zero, when you do this sort of tide of projection, you can choose a G0, which gives you, actually, if you look in K-space, which gives you something here, which can be, you have to look carefully, but it can give something which gives an imaginary part which is negative. And it's related to the fact that really if you take all the diagrams, the thing is causal, but then if you just put something to zero, in principle, you can choose a certain type of hopping that gives you something which is not causal. Again, this doesn't mean that in general, if you apply this to a certain problem, perhaps the system will be causal, but you will not find problem. Okay, so the solution of Mills to this problem was the traveling cluster approximation, and what we are trying to do with GABI is try to do the same thing for strongly correlated electrons. The problem is that he didn't have this problem because this type of diagram are not there in the case of disorder system, just because you have no loops because the replica goes to zero, the number of replica goes to zero. So it's not so straightforward, but we are just working on that. So in principle, I had also to discuss some application, but perhaps the time is we can discuss after all. I continue. I continue.
How long is the way?
10 minutes. Or 5 minutes if I just describe the time.
Give you.
Okay,
15 minutes.
Okay, so let me describe the toy model and then we will see if I continue also for the Hubble. So one thing that we did is just to try to test this approximation in a case in which we can solve the model exactly, in which we can also solve exactly the impurity problem. So what we have done is it's applied the dynamical cluster mean field approximation to this system, which is one dimensional, so it should be in principle one, okay, should be a worst case. And so this is the SUN one dimensional Heisenberg model. Actually, it's not exactly like this. We have just throw away a term which was the nearest neighbor density-density interaction. And it's the same model that has been studied by Afflecker Marston in two dimensions. So it's easy to see that when n goes to infinity, you can solve this problem. It's just because when n goes to infinity, this quantity don't fluctuate. And so what you are going to do is that this quantity will just renormalize the hopping. Just you will take this C with this C, you will say that this is chi, and this will give a renormalized hopping for the C. And then you will have a self-consistent equation on chi. So this is the solution of the problem. And what we have done is, now try, we have the exact solution now, we can apply the different mean field approximation to the problem that we can solve exactly, so we don't have to do the QMC. And so actually there are two points which are important. I will not describe everything. So here is the chi. so the point are just the exact solution for the chi as a function of beta. Okay, for a certain for t equal 1, I think, and the chemical potential equal to 1, but the things doesn't change if I change the parameter. So what you get then, when you solve the problem, again, you one thing which is very important is that in the cluster problem, you have one thing which is what you obtain from the solution of the cluster equation, and the other thing is the lattice quantity. So for example, for the self-energy, you have a self-energy inside the cluster, and you have a lattice self-energy. Then if you want, for example, to compute chi, it's a general problem for if you look things. If you want to compute chi, which is this thing, you have two choices. One choice is you say, okay, I know the propagator inside the cluster, I will take at least a cluster of two sides, so from the solution I can look at the propagator inside the cluster between I and I plus 1, and I can get chi from the cluster solution. The other thing that I can do is, okay, if I have sigma inside the cluster, I compute with some rules the sigma lattice with the rules that I gave before, for example. And when I have the self-energy of the lattice, I recompute the Green function for the lattice. And the Green function for the lattice will not coincide with the Green function of the cluster if one looks just at the point inside the cluster. And this is because the cavity procedure is not exact. In this case, if it was exact, the two things should coincide. So you have two choices, and it's important to see that they are different. So here, what I plot is the chi obtained from the cluster solution. So take the propagator inside the cluster and you look. And here are different comparisons. Okay, here I don't want to go into the details if one converges faster than the other, if CDMFT or DCA. But you see that already, okay, CDMFT already with a cluster of two sites is very good. DCA, you have just to improve a little bit to increase the number of sites of your cluster. But then you go very quickly toward the exact solution. Now, the other thing which is important is that you can do this, but you can do also the other thing, which is just estimate chi from the lattice propagator. And in that case, things change, at least for DCA. So this curve, is just the chi cluster for DCA. And then, the points, again, are the exact solution. And all the other curves are, okay, I will not discuss in details, but are the chi lattice for DCA and for CDMFT. And so what you see is that things improve a lot for DCA when you consider the lattice quantity, and actually for CDMFT it remains more or less stable. And this also say that probably because DMST is based on the idea of the cavity procedure is doing better in the case of CDMFT than in the case of DCA. And it also say that if you want to do things with DCA, you should take the lattice quantity for. Okay, so for CDMFT, at the end of the if you reach convergence, you have sigma alpha beta. You have sigma alpha beta. Okay, at the end, then you can estimate sigma lattice, for example, like I've said before, from sigma, which is a function of sigma cluster. Then you can compute G. Let's say G of X, like, so you have I omega n plus Q minus T minus sigma lattice, so T of K minus sigma lattice of K, KX. Okay, this is G lattice. And then you have G alpha beta, okay? So let's say that you want to compute chi. So what is chi? Chi is related to G, for example, 1, 2 cluster. That is also equal to, G when X is equal to, 2 minus 1 lattice. Sorry. Chi cluster, and this is chi lattice. G lattice. And again, if the cavity procedure would do exactly, the two things should be the same. But it's not doing exactly, so the two things are different.
They converge.
Yeah, they convert to the same thing, yeah, sure, right. But you see that for DCA, for example, these are quite different from CDMFT. They are not so different, so it means that probably for CDMFT, the cavity procedure is slightly better. And then the other things, I just show an example of self-energy. So the right self-energy is this one with the triangle. And then the DCA self-energy, so when you just create a cluster of two sites, is this. As I said before, it's a piecewise constant. And then you see that it converged toward the exact solution if you take a cluster which is larger and larger. I think it's very nice, you see, the way to converge. And also you can do also this. Okay, with CDMFT is different because you don't have something which is constant. And actually what we have found is that if you just do the procedure which is that I described before, what we get with a cluster of two sites is this one. Okay? It's not so good. And then it converges to the exact solution if you take a cluster which is larger and larger. In that case, however, we could try a different way to extract sigma lattice from sigma cluster, and then we get the good solution. Okay, we also know what in this case what was the exact solution, so it was easy to guess and the right thing. But it's just to stress that you have to think about how to extract the sigma lattice from the sigma cluster.
The solid line is for cluster size 2, but the correct guess for sigma lattice.
With the guess. So, the solid line here is with is a two-side cluster with a different in, way to get sigma lattice from. And if you use the one that I gave before, what you get is this. So again, just to stress that, okay, there is not a unique way in CDMFT to extract the sigma lattice, and in general you can try to see if there are an intelligent way or... and also, I think the other important point that sigma cluster is different. I mean, the things in the cluster can be different from the things in the lattice, and you have to be careful. Yeah, actually, in this case, the pair scheme will give the exact result. The pair scheme will give the exact result in this case. And there is no problem of causality because there is no I omega n nowhere. Okay. It's really a toy model. Yeah. Okay. So, now I don't know if you want to continue. In principle, now I have some physical result, finally. On the two-dimensional Abramo that half filling without frustration. Okay, I go ahead. It's just again, it's just to discuss some points which change between DMFT and CDMFT. I think now we will have quite soon many more interesting results. But okay, the first thing that one can do is now that you have this cluster scheme, is try to do what happened to the mode transition in the case of the Hubbard model with T prime equal to zero, so without frustration. So the problem is clearly is well understood in the case of DMFT, and you can ask what happened in the case of CDMFT. So the first thing that we have done, so is, okay, compute the phase diagram. So T is equal to minus 0.25, so the half the bandwidth is 1, and so this is in unit of half bandwidth. And what you have, so this is the type of phase diagram. So you have the paramagnetic phase here and the antiferromagnetic phase, which will go probably very slowly here. And there is a second order phase transition between the two. And okay, now what we have tried to look at is to look at if there is a sign of mode transition somewhere. And so, sorry? Okay. The blue things are the point in which I ran the CDMFT, which correspond to the results which are here and here. So here are the results at t equals 0.2 for different value of u. So here are the same points, and here are the spectral density for the same points. And so what you see is that the first thing is to see at the double occupancy, to see in principle if one is near the mode transition, above but near the mode transition, this thing should not be smooth, should be something which has a variation which is rapid. And here you see something which has not a real rapid variation. And if you look at the density of states at the same, so in the same point, what you have, okay, you have a density of state which go from one peak to the two Hubbard band. But I mean, this is just trivial, just because, okay, you take u very large, so you are going to the toward the atomic limit, and so you have the two Hubbard band which are opening. So then, sorry?
So you have a three-peak solution in the peak, so you have a one-peak solution.
So there is no peak here.
And so you have the Hubble band, the large U, so in between you should have the three peaks.
No, it's not here for the moment. You see, there's just one.
Okay,
for the moment it's not here. So what then one could try to see, to say something or to look in a region of parameter in which you hope to see it, okay? So actually, the question is, okay, this is the phase diagram. There is no standard way, there is a gap which is opening, which is trivial. I mean, there is just the two peak which are here. And then you can ask what happened to the mode transition that you know in the NFT, okay?
Yeah,
exactly, this is very high temperature. So, exactly. So what you have to do, in principle, you should look a line which is here, and not the line which is there, okay? So it's what we did. But there is a difference, which is a physical difference. So now, what we have been to do and what we have done, so I will show you the result, is just, okay, let's look at the line which is here, okay? And this, now, there is a problem. I mean, in the NFT, you can do that, so when it's unfrustrated. So here, physically, what happens is that the paramagnetic solution here is completely unstable physically, because, okay, there is a second order transition. But in the NFT, you can look at the solution, and the solution has a physical meaning, so even if it's numerically stable, but it's physically unstable, but has a physical meaning, because the same equation that you have when D go to infinity for the unfrustrated case are exactly the same of the same equation of a completely frustrated case. Okay, for the complete, so for the completely frustrated case, you still have the paramagnetic solution exactly like in the other case, but you don't have the antiferromagnetic solution. So you can, I mean, physically it has a sense, has a meaning to look at the solution here, because it's a physical solution of the completely frustrated system. Here there is no frustrated system, so it's just unfrustrated. So in principle, the first thing that one can do is that it's true that we would like to see what happens here, forcing the symmetry. Because if you don't force the symmetry in the cluster equation, then the system will become antiferromagnetic. So we can force the symmetry and see what happens. But there is a problem. This has a physical meaning or not? And actually, if it was, I mean, the answer that, okay, now I will show you what happens, and I will show you also why. Okay, one answer is that, okay, it's always good to know what happens and on this line. And the other is that, actually, what you can think is that in two dimensions, when you take a larger and larger cluster, the antiferromagnetism should go away at finite temperature. Should go away when the cluster is very, very large, because there are logarithmic long wavelength fluctuations. So you can try to look at this line, forcing the symmetry, and hope that the result that you get are just the result that you will get if you take a very large cluster and the antiferromagnetism is away. So that's the idea. And by the way, it's also what partially Gerard did. And so just to compare, so what we have done, we have done different on different lines. Line 1 over 7, which is just here, and then 1 over 15, which is more or less here. And now I will show you what are the results. And the result, I think, they are clearly say something. So the first thing we can plot, so these are different curves. So the red is beta equal 5, is beta equal 7, beta equal 15. This is the double occupancy. So you see that as a function of u, nothing changed when you go down beta. And then if you look at the antiferromagnetic lotus susceptibility, now you find that something is happening, because when you increase u, this is really going up when you go down in beta. And again, this is normal, because what you are doing, I think it's nice to think in terms of a classical analog. So think if you do a sort of classical mean field approximation, a cluster mean field approximation to a ferromagnetic antiferromagnetic Ising model. And then what you are saying so is that the cavity field on one side is just the sum over, so on I is just the sum over all the neighbor, is the sum over all the neighbor of beta j mj, okay, where m is the magnetization. So if you just force the symmetry, what you are doing, at least in that case, is just you are taking a free cluster, okay? It's not like this in CDNFT, it's just a cartoon, okay? If you take a free cluster and you look at this in the phase in which you know that the system wants to be antiferromagnetic, you go to low temperature, so what you are looking, you will find a distribution which is just the sum over the two distributions, so the one at low temperature, which is like this, plus half, the other one, so which is like that, okay? Now what I would like to say, so is that if you force the symmetry, if you go down in temperature, everything on short length scale is exactly like if you have an antiferromagnetic phase. But then you don't have the staggered magnetization because you force the symmetry. And the way to see this is that now, if you look at the... So first thing, you look at the local antiferromagnetic susceptibility, which is really going up. And then you look at the density of states. So here T prime is still equal to 0, beta equal 15 as a function of U. And what you see, so you have a peak here. So the green is for U equal 1, then U equal 1.2, 1.5, and 2. Okay? Then let's say let's focus on 1.5, so the red curve. So you have these two things, which are the two Hubble band. And then the way to interpret these two peaks Actually, there is a simple way that you can interpret in this way. Just if you just take the Hubble model, you make the R3 FOC, and you will find that at zero temperature you will have an antiferromagnetic transition, and then you will have a gap here, and this is the precursor of the gap, and you will have two peaks with a width which is more or less proportional to J, which is 4T squared over U. And then you can think that these two peaks are just exactly what I'm talking about. And then, so here there is a gap which is opening, that is opening because of the antiferromagnetic correlation. And the way to check this interpretation is just take the same model at the same temperature, the same value of U, but put the T prime, so if you frustrate the model, and if the antiferromagnetic correlation are the one which are important, then you should find that this characteristic goes away. And indeed, the black curve is the one when T prime is equal to zero, and the red curve is the one when T prime is 0.15 of T, which is slightly asymmetric because the doping, okay, you don't have particle symmetry, so doping is not exactly zero. So this is a confirmation of the fact that if you want, if there is a gap which is opening, but is opening because of Slater mechanism, not like the same mechanism that you find in the DMFT in infinite dimension. Then the thing which is interesting then is to put a T prime and look at the mode transition when the system is frustrated, and then see how things change, and then see, I don't know, many other things that are very interesting. That's all.